us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The blood is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Radio!
I take him, he has been an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
He's going out of here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
A bunch of a-holes.
Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? Where are you going to hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Check your systems, are all gone.
Mario!
I'll write it, and we'll do it live.
What the hell's going on out here?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're ready. Because there's no one like you left.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough.
503 Central. West Coast Mountains, West Coast. Iceland. Happy Australia. Welcome, kiddies, to the award-winning Adventure Conference back in the other, heard every Monday and Thursday here at Revolution.radio. Broadcasting live. From the state where nothing is allowed, the home location where we have a high, kiddies, of three above. Yes, the number three, the number that comes after two, but before four, it is three above. Three, Trace, three above, kids. That's the temperature.
That's the temperature.
I certainly hope you are, let me relive some of the numerous conversations I have with my fellow Minnesotans who around this time of the year start just losing their collective minds because it's too cold. It's the wind chill. And I keep reminding them, fellow Minnesotans, between the months of December and, geez, we'll even go through March. It can be below digits for a high. single digits for a high. It can snow one day, the next day be 43 degrees. It can snow one day, be 20 below the next day, and 42 above the next day. That's how it works. That's how it works in Minnesota. Minnesota's a bit like Iceland. If you're not happy with the weather, wait longer. Let's see who's in the chat room this evening. I almost forgot how to get to the chat room. How do I get to the chat room? Oh, there it is. The visitor list. It's old age, as my mom says. ID, hello, not much to it. O.E. McVeigh, Curon, Flippy, Who Me, Rudolph, good evening. Pac-Woman, hello. The Last Down Under. I was talking about you the other day, Pac-Woman. Somebody asked me, well, who listens to the radio? And I said, well, they don't sound like that, but that's... I tend to make younger people sound like they're old. Well, Mario, who listens to the radio? Who listens to your program? I said, I got no idea. I mean, there can be 37 people in the chat room or 106, and we've got two studios. But the reason I mentioned you, Pac-Woman, is because I mentioned to that person when she asked, well, who listens to your show? And I said, well, I have spoken to a woman who lives in Australia. Well, where does she live? And I said, I don't know, north of Sydney someplace. Well, where? I got no clue. They're somewhere north of Sydney. Big D 1955, my name's Sammy. Hello, Sammy. Cat Dog Girl, Captain Fred, New Zealand. Is that New Zealand? Yes, because that's where it says you're located. The Water Bears Tribune.com. Christine C. Caught your program, Christine C. Good evening. Shadow Play Live from the UK, Walter Mauser, Grog, Blessing, Jocelyn, Gray Scout, Wally. Good evening. Batsman up north in Canada. Who Devo from the UK, Mona, good old US of A, Dr. Who, blah, blah, Patrick Cornelius Rabbit III. This week he's going by Pagan Rabbit. Last week it was Nasty Rabbit. Who knows what will happen either Thursday or next week. The Red Pill from St. Catharines in Canada. Monster 383, which equals 14, Sheared Sheep, Comet, Dirt, Festus B, Dirt Engineer, Fled number 2. Checking in from the good old U.S. of A. Dry Fly Guy, Fierce Lightning, Noreen, Jerbear, your friends are here. His location is 3B27, but I believe he lives in Nevada. Jim Bob, XXX47, no clue where he is. Surrey Sunflower, The Last Across the Waterhole, that'd be the U.K. The retired Reverend Dr. Mr. Rowe, my favorite host. A mad painter, you'll see some of his beautifully designed work at the store tab at revolution.radio. Don't forget, we are 100% listener-supported. Nisomania, Choppy Water, my favorite chat name, Popsicle Toes, and rounding up the group, I'm sorry, in the kitchen with Martha. Good evening, one and all. I hope you all are doing well on this glorious, glorious evening. Doc is from Chile. Wait, isn't Jer from Nevada? Nevada? Did I say Nevada? Nevada. I don't know. Nevada, potato. How does that song go? I don't remember how it goes. It goes some way. Nevada, did I say Nevada? Well, sometimes I think I'm from Canada or Canada. I like to say oot and roof, a boot, out, oot, potato, tomato, potato. There's that song. It goes like, let's throw the whole thing on. I don't know. There's also that rapey Christmas song, too, that apparently they don't play anymore and has been canceled. Ba-ba Black Sheep. We're going off somewhere where I don't know where we're supposed to be going, but let's get back on the train, kids. So in my crack research of numerous things online to keep you entertained here, kids, I came across an interesting case. It's not quite 411 because Politis didn't cover it. However, let me share with you. This is a bit of a deep dive. Let me share with you or summarize for you the key events of the Starved Rock murders of the 1960s in some recent updates. Mario, Sydney's in the state of New South Wales. I am in Queensland State and out north of Brisbane. Okay. All right. Thank you. So there's a bit of the minutiae to go into here, kids, but I'm going to just keep the highlights. So Starved Rock State Park became the first recreational park owned by the state of Illinois when it was purchased in 1911, but had been developed privately as a destination for vacationers in the late 19th century, situated on the bank of the Illinois River and famed for its many canyons. Visitors can enjoy 13 miles of hiking trails with overlook views and waterfalls, as well as recreational fishing, boating, and camping. Only 90 miles southwest of Chicago, Starved Rock remains the most popular state park in Illinois. Interestingly, I've never heard Politis refer to the Starved Rock State Park in any of his missing 411 escapades. Well, on this faithful day, March 14th, 1960, three friends take a trip. Those three friends, Lillian Oating, age 50, Francis Murphy, 47, and Mildred Lindquist, 50, all resided in the Riverside neighborhood of Chicago. Wives, all three of prominent businessmen, they planned a four-day getaway to Starved Rock State Park and set off, as I mentioned, on Monday, March 14th, 1960. After checking into the Starved Rock Lodge, they ate lunch before heading out for a hike to St. Louis Canyon, an approximately 2-mile return track with views to a spring-fed waterfall. They took Francis Murphy's camera and set off through the snowy landscape. Oating's husband, George, was expecting to hear from his wife that evening. When he received no call from her, he rang the hotel. Staff told him she wasn't available and suggested she might call the next morning. Unconcerned, George wondered if perhaps they had gone out for the evening. He called again the next morning and was told the three women had been at breakfast together that morning and must have gone out. George was reassured by this, even though the sighting would prove to be mistaken. A late winter storm hit the area late that night, with near blizzard conditions blanketing the area with several inches of snow. Again, kids, this is not a missing 411 case, but at this point, does have some missing 411, I hate to use the phrase, profile points, one being the weather changed drastically. On Wednesday morning, George Oating called the lodge again, and when he could not reach his wife for the third time, insisted staff check on their room. They discovered the beds unslept in and their bags still packed. The station wagon belonging to Murphy remained parked outside the lodge. The women had been unaccounted for at this point by almost 40 hours. Alarmed, George phoned his friend Virgil W. Peterson, operating director of the Chicago Crime Commission. Word of the missing friend soon reached the LaSalle County Sheriff's Office, who prepared to begin the search. Unfortunately, the bodies of the three women were soon found by several boys recruited to the search from a nearby state correctional camp. Found on their backs under a small rock ledge, two of the women were naked from the waist down, while the third was still found wearing a girdle. Two of them were bound together with white string, and all had been viciously beaten around the head. In clearing the recently fallen snow, the site was disturbed by investigators, and potential evidence may have been destroyed. Nearby, they found Murphy's camera, case smeared with blood and the strap broken, a pair of bloodied binoculars, and a frozen tree limb also covered in blood. They determined the branch was likely the murder weapon, but after studying the scene, considered it likely that the murder had taken place deeper in the canyon, and then the bodies dragged under the ledge. Autopsies concluded that the women had been killed shortly after lunching, at the lodge, but were unable to determine if sexual assaults had taken place. Robbery was considered unlikely, as the women had left their valuables behind in the hotel room. Initial theories held that more than one attacker was likely involved, as it would have been very difficult for a single person to overpower and control three able women. With little evidence to go on, the investigation failed to make headway for months following the murders. Matters were further complicated by jurisdictional tensions between the state's attorney and the state police. State investigators suggested that Chicago mobsters had committed the murders in an act of retribution against Crime Commissioner Virgil Peterson, a close family friend of all three women. State Attorney Harold Warren doubted that gangsters would travel 100 miles to commit such a murder and bring a weapon with them. Pressure from the press to solve the crime was constant, and investigation costs mounted. A small gold ring belonging to Oding, which was thought missing, sparked hopes of a new lead, but instead caused more scandal when it was found, overlooked, inside her bloody glove. Against these increasing pressures, Warren Harland decided to spend his own money to purchase a microscope and take a closer look at the two kinds of twine which had been wrapped around two of the victims. This led him to match both kinds of twine to that found in the Starved Rock Lodge's kitchen, where it was used for wrapping food. All the lodge workers had already been subjected to questioning via polygraph, an unreliable method, as most of you know, but Warren ordered them to be questioned once again. This was when Chester Wegger came under suspicion. Chester Wegger, or Wedger, was a 21-year-old man with a wife and two young children. At the time of the murders, he was working in the lodge's kitchen. Wedger's failure of the subsequent polygraph test brought him under suspicion. Wedger cooperated with investigators, surrendering a buckskin jacket with suspicious dark stains. Test confirms the stain is blood, although sources differ as to whether it is confirmed to be human. And by September, investigators had begun constant surveillance of Wedger and attempted to connect him to a robbery and sexual assault which occurred 2 months before the Starved Rock murders in a nearby park, where the assailant bound the female teenage victim with twine. After failing another series of polygraph tests, and with the victims of the earlier assault identifying Wedger's photograph as that of her attacker, Wedger is arrested. He has questions about the 1959 assault, and in an interrogation that lasts beyond midnight, Wedger confessed to the murders, saying he attempted to rob the women and killed them when they fought back. Wedger signed a confession typed up for him and led a reenactment of the crime for police and reporters at St. Louis Canyon. Following his first meeting with attorneys, however, Wedger retracted his confession, stating investigators threatened him with a gun and told him they would send him to the electric chair. Wedger maintained this retraction throughout his trial and conviction for one of the murders, that of Lillian Oding. Prosecutors sought conviction for only one of the murders so that further trials could be pursued if a conviction was not secured for Oding's murder. Wedger received a life sentence on March 4, 1961, despite the death penalty initially being sought. Now we've got some doubt on the conviction. Chester Wedger maintained his innocence throughout his incarceration. In a letter to the Chicago Tribune on April 20th, 1963, Wedger wrote, and I quote, "Now there's nothing in the world that I needed bad enough to kill for," end quote. He refused on multiple occasions to admit guilt to secure release on parole reviews. There appears to be no physical evidence linking Chester to the crime scene, and no witnesses place him at the scene of the crime. There is, however, physical evidence which suggests Wedger could be innocent. Blonde and black hairs found on the victims, including on the finger of Francis Murphy's glove and the palm of Lillian Oding, were found to be dissimilar to Wedger's hair. No hair or fiber evidence was presented at trial, despite numerous samples being collected at the scene. The presence of both black and blonde hairs on the victims strongly suggests the presence of two killers, in line with the investigator's own initial assessment. Wedger claimed that his initial motive for the attack was robbery. However, all the victims had their jewelry on them when found. Decades after the conviction, a juror admitted to the Chicago Tribune in 2016 that she found Wedger's confession, quote, "implausible," end quote, at the time. Wedger's current attorneys, Andy Hale and Stack, argue that a case such as this would have never made it to trial under today's standards. An alleged deathbed confession surfaced in 2006 in an affidavit signed by Chicago Sergeant Mark Gibson, included in a motion to support new DNA testing. Gibson states that around 1982, he visited a woman in a hospital to help her, quote, "clear her conscience," end quote. The woman told the officer, quote, "things got out of hand," quote, at a state park that, quote, "they dragged the bodies," end quote. Gibson reported that this confession was cut short by the woman's daughter, who said her mother was not of sound mind. The affidavit did not name the woman, nor did it address whether there had been any follow-up after the initial reporting of the incident. The DNA testing was granted, allowing hairs found at the scene and the buckskin jacket to be tested, but failed to provide any new information as the samples were corrupted. Wedger was denied parole 23 times over the course of a sentence. He was finally granted parole on November 21st, 2019, but his release was delayed until February 21st of 2020 under review against the state's Sexually Violent Persons Commitment Act at the time of his release. He was the longest serving inmate in Illinois prison history. October 26, 2000. 21, just 2 months ago, new permission was granted to test evidence using contemporary techniques. This includes cigarette butts, hairs, and string found at the crime scene. LaSalle County prosecutors opposed the testing, claiming the evidence had been improperly stored and even handled by students on field trips. It remains to be seen if this testing provides any further information or if contamination interferes as it did in the 2006 tests. As you might imagine, there is a forthcoming HBO documentary, The Murders at Starved Rock. Could be interesting viewing, kids, as it follows investigation into the Wedger's conviction by his son of the lead prosecutor in the original trial. As noted, kids, this is just a summary of the events. If you would like, I am going to post a couple of links in the room for you. If you care to read more on it, these are the sources of information that I gleaned. Why am I screaming like I'm going through puberty? That I gleaned this information from. Again, why do we do this? Because when you do research, folks, you have to provide source material for the listeners, and then here, actually here, these are the last, here we go, there we go, there you go, there are the last sourced sites for this story. And in case you're wondering, in case you're wondering, kids, if you go to this website right here, Chicago Tribune, you will see a picture of Mr. Chester Wedger. Gosh. 1960 to 2000 is 40, 21, 61 years. 61 years, if my math is correct. For 61 years. It's a long time to maintain innocence. It's a long time to maintain innocence, kids. Long time. Let's visit our friends over at Bedtime Stories.
During the autumn of 1903, numerous inhabitants of one Iowan city were subjected to a series of terrifying encounters with a mysterious winged intruder. Over a century later, both the origins and ultimate fate of this enigmatic creature continue to remain shrouded in mystery. Join us this week as we examine the bewildering story of the Van Meter Visitor. Pulling his coat a little tighter to his chest in an effort to stave off the paralyzing effects of the cold night air, Eugene Griffith found himself wondering just how late the hour truly was. A cursory check of his pocket watch soon confirmed the salesman's worst fears. It was already gone 1 o'clock in the morning, far later than he had promised his wife he would be returning from his rounds. Quickening his pace, Griffith hurried through the city's business district, which was unsurprisingly devoid of activity due to the lateness of the hour. Yet even without having to negotiate obstacles such as other pedestrians or traffic, the door to his abode still remained a frustrating 10-minute hike away. The businessman had managed to make it halfway along Main Street when something had brought him to an abrupt halt. There, atop the roof of the nearby Mather and Greggs building, someone had placed an open lantern which was burning brightly, its light spilling onto the street below. Taking into account the time, and believing that no honourable man should have any business on a rooftop at such an hour, Griffith was more than a little perturbed by the sight. Having decided it was within his civic duty to investigate, he proceeded to walk confidently out into the middle of the road and call out a challenge. Almost immediately, and to his utter surprise, the light from the lantern suddenly leapt into the sky, travelling several metres up the street and then landing on another rooftop. Dumbfounded, Griffith was momentarily at a loss as to how to proceed, before again persuading himself something illicit must be afoot. As he began a determined pace along the building line, he again called out, demanding the holder of the lantern descend from the roof and identify themselves. Once again, the result of his order was that the ball of burning light instead hurtled up into the sky, this time sailing directly over the top of him and settling on a roof situated on the opposite side of the street. Completely stunned by what he was seeing, Griffith could only watch on in further amazement as the light now rose vertically up into the sky. It travelled in a steady and unwavering path directly upwards, before suddenly appearing to vanish into thin air. Griffith stood perfectly still for a short time, waiting for the mysterious light to reappear. When it did not, he slowly shook his head in wonder, before continuing on his way. Resolving to speak with the owners of the buildings he had seen the light on the following morning, he again quickened his pace, eager to make up for the time he had just lost. UG Griffith was a prominent and popular member of the community in the city of Van Meter, and so on the morning of September the 30th, 1903, when he began to talk about his experiences, people naturally stopped and listened. As a result of Griffith's claims, the roofs and upper levels of the buildings in question were checked for any potential trace of a prowler, but there was nothing to be found. Whilst the day wore on, the businessman's story began to spread throughout the city, naturally resulting in a palpable increase in community tension. It was of little surprise then that just after midnight the following evening, some of the town's inhabitants were feeling particularly nervous about who or what it was that one of their number had allegedly encountered. Amongst this group was a local physician named Dr. Alcott. He had been lying on a cot in his back office, struggling to get off to sleep, when a bright and unnatural light had unexpectedly shone into the room through the window. Convinced this must be the same prowler that Griffith had sighted the previous evening, clearly now looking to force entry, Alcott pulled his pistol from his desk drawer and ran downstairs. But what he saw when he exited the building would end up haunting him for the rest of his days. Clinging to the wall immediately outside his office window was a monster right from the depths of hell. It was largely humanoid in shape, possessing a huge wingspan, and with what appeared to be a long beak protruding from its face. The lengthy talons which the creature possessed at the termination of each wing were unlike any known species of bird, and seemed as unnatural as the blunt horn that jutted from the center of its forehead. Alcott could see that it was this bizarre extension that was somehow projecting the unearthly light in through his window, and was like nothing he had ever seen before. With a cry of terror, the doctor raised his pistol and fired, at which point the creature looked down at him, inadvertently blinding him with the light that was pouring forth from its horn. In desperation, Alcott fired his weapon a further four times, at which point the entity gave a piercing shriek and then flew off quickly into the night. The following morning, the authorities found several spent shell casings on the ground outside the doctor's office, as well as what appeared to be minor damage to the brickwork and wooden sill around the window. But there was no sign of blood, or that the bullets which had been fired had in any way adversely affected the strange intruder. When added to the testimony of Mr. Griffith, the good doctor's alleged encounter had quite the detrimental effect on his fellow citizens, with several deciding to take steps to protect both themselves and their businesses from the machinations of this nocturnal intruder. As darkness once again fell upon the city, a lone figure sat holed up inside the city bank. Clarence Dunn was employed as a teller at the premises, and had decided to spend the night on the bank floor with his shotgun, in the event that it turned out to be the next premises to be targeted. After a time, Dunn had dozed off, but was subsequently awoken by a bizarre gargling and rasping sound coming from just outside one of the nearby windows. Checking his watch and realizing that it was past 1 a.m, he reached for his weapon and then cautiously headed across the room towards the source of the noise. But as Dunn had reached the window and peered out into the darkness, he had been immediately blinded by a brilliant light, which had shone in through the glass and into his face. Staggering backwards, the bank employee had rubbed his eyes vigorously with his free hand, before opening them again to see that the mysterious beam of light was now sweeping back and forth across the room. As it had swiveled from right to left, seemingly searching the inside of the premises, Dunn had caught a glimpse of the nightmarish and demonic face behind it, complete with a pointed snout full of sharp teeth and a pair of soulless dead eyes. Without hesitation, the teller's finger had automatically tightened against the trigger of the shotgun, firing the weapon directly through the window at the creature, which was lurking outside. The glass had instantly shattered as the buckshot smashed into the small panes, with the creature once again fixing him in the beam of light being projected from the center of its head, before disappearing into the night. The following morning, the police found what appeared to be footprints on the floor outside the window. They were abnormally large in size, with three toes sticking out from the end of each imprint. Several efforts would be made to take plaster casts of these, each unfortunately proving unsuccessful. The following evening, there would be yet another traumatic encounter with the creature, this time at a hardware store, situated a little further along Main Street from the location of the original sighting. As with Clarence Dunn, the proprietor, O.V. White, had been awoken by an odd rasping noise coming from the street outside. Seizing his rifle, he had hurried out of a side door to find a large shape regarding him from a position perched on top of a nearby telegraph pole. But before he could open fire, the figure had opened its wings and emitted a horrific and overpowering odor. As White had dropped to his knees, choking and coughing, the creature had immediately taken flight, passing over the head of another shopkeeper named Sidney Gregg, who had heard the commotion. Both men watched on as the winged figure slowly disappeared from sight, heading in the direction of the aging coal mine around which the city had originally been built. The following morning, when the pair had related their experience to their neighbors, it was decided that enough was enough. Having been confronted by a deputation of angry local business owners, the mayor had sent for the director of the mine to be brought before him. A rather flustered Mr. Platt arrived a short time later, unsure of why he had been summoned. But after a brief back and forth with the city elders, Platt revealed that some of his men had recently reported strange sounds floating up from the depths of several long-abandoned shafts located near the main site. Their claims had largely been dismissed as nonsense. That evening, a couple of armed men were posted to watch the mine entrance, with orders to notify the police if they saw or heard anything suspicious. In no time at all, they had subsequently come hurrying back into the city to report that they had not seen one, but two of the entities emerge from the mine shaft and fly off up into the night. A combined force of miners and local residents were promptly pulled from their beds and set off to lay a hasty ambush for the creatures, which both reappeared just as dawn was breaking. Descending towards the mine, they were subjected to a volley of murderous gunfire. The only effect that the hail of buckshot and bullets seemed to have on the two entities was to produce inhuman screams and further noxious emissions. Despite numerous hits, neither creature seemed to sustain any form of injury, instead flying directly past the townsfolk and fleeing back into the abandoned mine works. Wasting no time at all, the men who were present had quickly dynamited the entrance to the shaft in question, ensuring that no one could access it or that anything could get out. Volunteers were posted over the next week and a half to search for any sight or sound of the creatures, but nothing further was ever seen or heard of them. It may be that the Van Meter visitors eventually passed away in the depths of the mine shaft, or somehow found a different way to escape into the wilderness. But in truth, nobody can say. In the century that has passed since the people of Iowa fought off and drove away their mysterious winged trespasser, the story of the Van Meter visitor has grown into a global legend. The enigmatic creature now stands shoulder to shoulder with other notorious flying cryptids, such as the Mothman and the Lawndale Thunderbird. But at the time of the alleged sightings, the story was largely dismissed by commentators. Despite being described in great detail by a number of local newspapers, national distributors were highly skeptical that the incident had ever taken place, citing a notable lack of supporting evidence. But to the people of Van Meter, there is little doubt that this bizarre occurrence did indeed take place. The witnesses to it were amongst the city's most affluent residents, hard-working men of learning and standing, all impassioned and consistent in their description of the beast. And yet, over a century later, nothing even remotely resembling this fantastic creature has ever been encountered anywhere else on this earth. It seems the unnatural combination of a flying monster with the ability to project a beam of light from its body is almost too bizarre a phenomenon to replicate. Some who have investigated the matter have speculated that it may have been a prank executed by local youths, using flying lanterns backed up with animal calls, which were misinterpreted by an already frightened and intimidated populace. Others have gone further, claiming that the town was experiencing severe economic issues around the time of the incident. They believe that elements within the city council deliberately concocted the story in the hopes that national interest would bring tourism and investment to the community. The dawn of the 20th century was a fitful and worrying time for the American people. With the memory of the Civil War still lingering in the minds of the older generation, and indications that a confrontation of a similar scale was brewing in mainland Europe, tensions were high. A number of infamous hoaxes took place around the same time, such as in Cardiff, New York, where the skeleton of an alleged giant turned out to be a money-making scheme by a local grifter, and in the state of Texas, where a slew of reports describing dragons and flying lizards turned out to be simple trickery. Ultimately, the reason for the longevity of the story surrounding the Van Meter visitor is because of its truly unique elements. The description of the creature remains unique in cryptid lore, so outlandish and fantastic that it eclipses scientific argument and the lack of any physical evidence. Whether the creature did exist, or the people of the time merely willed it into existence, it continues to live on in some form to this day, like so many more of North America's shadowy and monstrous interlopers.
Thank you to our friends over at Bedtime Stories for this week's edition of Creepy Things That Fly Around in the Night. Some things are just unanswerable. If you didn't know about it, kids, Juicy Smollett took the witness stand today, Monday, at his trial on charges of staging a racist anti-gay attack on himself and lying to Chicago police about it. But as you can imagine, the actor says it was not a hoax. Smollett told the jury how he grew up in a close-knit family of six children and started performing as a child actor before getting more into music. What does this have to do with anything? I'm not quite certain. But apparently, he did meet in 2017, apparently one of the men that he is accused of paying off at a club in 2017. And the men did drugs together and went to a bathhouse where he said they made out. Over time, he and the two men did do more than drugs together, participated in sex acts together. Last week, Osundario testified that he and Smollett did not have a sexual relationship. So it's a he said, he said type thing. I'm not quite sure what's going on with this dude, but I think it has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Jussie Smollett made the whole thing up, paid the two Nigerian body/security guards off, got caught, and is now basically trying to CYA, or as they say on the street, CYA. I don't know if you can say the word ass. Well, I just did, but according to the New York Times, this is a bit of an older story, but I think it's always important. The murder of 9-year-old Candace Rogers rocked Spokane, Washington, but police identified John Ray Hoff as a suspect, and his daughter helped them solve the case. Dateline November 21st, 2021, about 3 weeks ago. On a Friday afternoon in 1959, Candace Rogers came home from school, played with her dog, ate an oatmeal cookie, and then set out to sell campfire mints in her neighborhood in Spokane, Washington. Candy, as she was known, was 9 years old, and a bluebird, a young member of the Campfire Girls, a youth group focused on outdoor activities. When Candy did not return home by dark, her grandfather, mother, friends, and neighbors began to look for her and were soon joined by police officers and sheriff's deputies. Around 9 p.m., boxes of campfire mints believed to be candies were found strewn along the road. Candy disappeared on March 6, 1959. Over the next 16 days, thousands of people searched for her. The effort included Marines, airmen, and military aircraft, but also residents on foot and horseback. An Air Force helicopter involved in the search crashed, killing 3 crew members. On the final week of the search, 1,200 people turned out. On March 21st, 1959, 2 off-duty airmen hunting in the woods about 7 miles from her house noticed a pair of children's shoes. The next morning, the police returned to the area and found Candy's body. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled with a piece of her own clothing. The crime rocketed, as you can imagine. Spokane, hundreds of tips poured in, but none led to Candy's killer, frustrating detectives who investigated the case decade after decade. On a Friday, more than 62 years after Candy was killed, the Spokane police announced they had solved the case with DNA evidence and old-fashioned detective work. The department identified the suspect as John Ray Hoff, who died by suicide in 1970 when he was 31. His daughter provided a DNA sample that linked her father to semen that had been found on Candy's clothing, which had been preserved as evidence at an era long before the advent of genetic testing at crime scenes. Mr. Hoff, who was buried in the same cemetery as Candy, was later exhumed, and after a DNA sample taken from his remains confirmed it was his semen, the police said. While the identification brought some relief to Candy's few surviving relatives, Sergeant Stormont said that it was agonizing to have to tell Mr. Hoff's widow and 4 children that Mr. Hoff was responsible for such a heinous crime. Mr. Hoff grew up in Spokane and had a record of petty juvenile crime. He joined the Army when he was 17 and served in Korea as an inventory clerk. He was 20 and lived about a mile away from Candy when she was killed in 1959. Again, one of the many cases that Pletus E. Pletus will not cover because Pletus E. Pletus is just a lazy SOB. Then finally, do you think the I-70 killer has struck again? If you don't know, the I-70 killer is an unidentified American serial killer who is known to have killed 6 store clerks in the Midwest in the spring of 1992. His nickname derives from the fact that several of the stores in which his victims worked were located a few miles off Interstate I-70. His victims were usually young, petite, brunette women. One of the women was a man. But it is believed he was mistaken for a woman by the killer, as he often wore a ponytail. All the stores attacked were specialty stores and were usually only robbed a few hundred dollars. He is also suspected of shooting 3 more store clerks in Texas during 1993 and 94, one of whom survived. Despite the case being featured on Unsolved Mysteries and Dark Minds, the killer is yet to be identified, and investigators have not publicly identified any suspects. However, is there a possible link between the murder of Billy Brosman that occurred on November 30th, 2001, at approximately 6:30 p.m., an unidentified man entered the 7th and 70 liquor store located at 2107 Prairieton Road in Terre Haute, Indiana, where he robbed, then shot and killed the store clerk, 31-year-old Billy Brossman, with a 38 caliber handgun without any known motive, while the whole incident was caught on surveillance camera. Police described the suspect as a white male between 5'8 and 6 feet, medium build, with thinning hair, between 30 to 40 years old. Several photos of the suspect were recovered from the store video and have been distributed since the homicide more than 20 years ago. In 2021, multiple sources close to the investigation told News 4 they were closely looking at a convenience store homicide in Terre Haute in 2001. Terre Haute Police Sergeant Troy Davis confirmed to News 4 there are similarities between the 2001 murder and the I-70 serial murders. Davis goes on to say, investigators have identified a person of interest in the 2001 case. The person is not in custody. Investigators emphasize they are looking at each case separately before drawing any conclusions at this point. As you can imagine, investigators are cautious to publicly make any connection between the cases at this point. But another police source told News 4 he is confident the person who killed Brossman is definitely a suspect as the I-70 killer. Police have long speculated as to why, after killing six people in 1 month in 92, the killer suddenly stopped. If the Brossman case can be connected, then he clearly did not. And if you wish to read more on this, here's a link to one of the sourced stories. And in this picture here, you will see a picture of the suspect. Interesting. Very, very, very interesting. Stand by. Sorry, I had to reprimand the cat. That's not for you to play with, buddy. You just sit right there. Again, cats, they get into everything. They get into everything. All right, folks, we're near the top of the hour break. Next hour, we head over across the big water hole to learn about murder, mayhem, and mystery from the Cotswolds. Also, we'll share a story with you regarding Fire Island John Doe identified after 32 years, another missing individual. This is Revolution.Radio, common spelling, in your favorite internet browser, where we are 100% listener supported. Now, what that means is this, is every donation that you make from a Benjamin Franklin to a Lincoln Penny goes to support this 800,000-watt internet blowtorch. And it's just this simple, kids. In your browser, type Revolution.Radio, common spelling. What does that mean? It's the way you spell revolution in radio. Revolution.radio. Top of the webpage, in the nav bar, you will see two important tabs. They're all important, but the two specifically for donating are the store tab as well as the donations tab. Now, the store tab, you click on that, you'll see a nice picture in the right corner, right side of the screen, rather, the designer, Thomas, or our own A Mad Painter, where you can click and send him a message. Right now, we are having a 30, 15, or 50% off sale, depending on what you choose. We've got coffee mugs. We've got Revolution Radio t-shirts. We have a Revolution Jump t-shirt in a black color. Very, very nice. We got one with a big, scary snake on it. I don't like snakes, but I would wear it for the cause. Also, on the website, click on the donations tab. A couple of options. You can become a Patreon. The donor box, direct payment, North America only, please. If you're into cryptocurrency, we have some options as well. Or if you just want to write a check, bottom of the screen, the snail mail address, it'll make its way to Allen, Michigan. Never been here. It's a nice place. If you have donated, if you're not in a position to donate, that's fine. Another way to support us, and it's completely free. completely free. Join the chat room, right? We are a wily bunch of immature individuals. Well, I'll speak for myself. Most are immature. Well, maybe it's just me. And I'll think about it over the break. Here comes the top of the hour music, folks. Back after this. Thanks for listening.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, folks, welcome back to This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday evenings here on Revolution.radio, 5 to 7 Central Time, 6 to 8 Eastern Time, 4 to 6 Mountain Time, 3 to 5 Pacific Time, early Tuesday morning and late Monday and Thursday evening. I'm sorry. 11, I'm sorry. 11 to 1 a.m. Is that 11 to 1 a.m. Iceland time? Is that how it works? Yeah. 11 to 1 a.m. Iceland time. In down under in Sydney, that would be what, 10 a.m. till noon on Tuesday morning or Friday morning, since, you know, technically it's Tuesday at 11 o'clock in a balmy 75 degrees. 71 right now in Sydney. A balmy 75 degrees. Here in my location, the great city of Minnesota, it's 2 above, which means you folks are 69 degrees warmer than us, or at least me. That's math, kids. All right, folks, sit back, relax. Some murder, mayhem, and mystery. More of that for you here on Revolution Radio.
This picture postcard, beautiful place, has on many occasions played host to murder, theft, beatings, and alcohol-fueled crimes of one kind or another. The night of Valentine's Day, 1945, is a night long remembered in the Quintons. It was on that night that Charles Walton, a local farm laborer, was found murdered at the Furze Farm on the slopes of Meon Hill. Even before this event, Meon Hill had been linked to many folklore stories involving devil worship. So it is perhaps fitting that such a gruesome event took place here. There is all kinds of speculation around the motive, including ideas as far-fetched as witchcraft and black magic. However, the residents of Quinton are renowned for their silence on the subject, and as recorded during a visit from the BBC some decades later, are tight-lipped to this day. We must tread carefully. Charles lived in a cottage opposite the church in Lower Quinton, renting it with his niece, Edie. The cottage is still there today, converted into one large property. Charles was apparently well-liked in the village, although described as something of a recluse and a loner, with a reputation for having an affinity with the animal kingdom. He had trained horses in his youth. It is said that wild birds would flock to his hand to be fed, and angry dogs could be tamed at the sound of his voice. He was a countryman through and through, familiar with many rural rituals and the ways of countryside. He was perhaps too familiar with it, for it is said that after seeing his strange abilities at work, some villagers believed him to be involved with witchcraft. When his body was found, his throat had been slashed by his own billhook, the implement with which he'd been trimming the hedgerows, and he was pinned to the ground by the neck with his own pitchfork. Witchcraft was certainly suspected, as a large cross was found carved into his chest. Previous cases have documented that people have murdered those they believed have put them under a spell. A cross carved into the victim was a sign of the person taking their revenge. To add to the witchcraft connection, during the investigation, a police officer found a book entitled Folklore, Old Customs and Superstitions in Shakespeare Land, written in 1929 by J. Harvey Bloom. A passage in the book tells of a Charles Walton who had died in 1885, 60 years before our victim, after seeing a foreboding ghost. As a result of this discovery, rumors started to circulate, suggesting that because of his alleged involvement with witchcraft, the more recently killed Charles Walton was the same man as the earlier victim. It was a notable case even at the time, and one of the most distinguished policemen in the country was called in to lead the investigation. Chief Inspector Robert Fabian of the Yard. However, despite his best efforts, the crime has never been solved. He had his suspicions, but he could prove nothing. Years later, though the event of that Valentine's Day remains fresh in the minds of the villagers, they were unquestionably tight-lipped. In the 1970s, the BBC Nationwide programme visited here in an attempt to discuss the case. But we hear tell that when they went to the local pub in Lower Quinton to interview the locals, the place suddenly emptied of customers and no one would speak to them. Surprisingly, Charles Wharton doesn't seem actually to have a grave in the churchyard. All that can be found is a small headstone with the initials marked CHW. This seems odd, but one theory has been suggested that it was destroyed by a relative who became upset by the media attention and the journalists who constantly visited the grave on the anniversary of his death. There are a number of footpaths round Meon Hill, so if you like a walk, don your walking boots and explore for yourself. If you choose to follow his path, tread carefully. From here we move south, back into the more familiar central Cotswolds, arriving first at the wonderful village of Chipping Campden.
Our story here is from the early 19th century, the year 1835. This is an unusual crime, because the criminal doesn't meet the usual stereotype. Harriet Tarver was just 21 when she committed her act of willful murder. She was a young mother with a perfectly decent record, living in Sheep Street. Her parents were both local, her father an agricultural worker by the name of William Tracy, and her mother, Sarah. Harriet was married at 19 to the 24-year-old Thomas Tarver. She had been to school and could read a little, but couldn't write at all. She worked by her husband's side as a labourer. In September 1834, the couple had had their first and only child, a daughter they named after Harriet's paternal grandmother, Anne.
They lived a normal working-class life in Chipping Campden, attracting little attention, until one day, December the 11th, 1835, Thomas died very suddenly. He was young, fit, and apparently healthy, so given that it was such a small community where everybody knew one another, it wasn't long before rumours of foul play and murder started to circulate. A few days after Thomas's death, on the 15th of December, an inquest was started. The inquest was not initially presented with any evidence of foul play, but it was adjourned for a week, and during this time, arsenic was discovered in Thomas's stomach. A couple of witnesses came forward to say that they had seen Harriet Tarver purchasing arsenic from a shop. They couldn't think why she would need it, but equally, why she would want her husband dead. The inquest jury, after some considerable discussion, returned a verdict of willful murder, and a trial took place on Friday the 8th of April, 1836. On the day Thomas died, he had gone to work at the Noel Arms in Chipping Campden as normal, leaving the house at around 4 a.m. It was shortly after his arrival that he began to complain of stomach pains. He was sick several times, and by the afternoon, he was dead. 2 days prior to this, Harriet had bought some rice pudding, and on the day Thomas died, she had given it to him for breakfast. It was in this pudding that she had hidden the arsenic. As she had been seen by several people buying the arsenic, it was rash of her to think she could administer it without question. Not the sharpest knife in the box, perhaps. Maybe she didn't think through the consequences. A post-mortem was carried out on Thomas, and arsenic was easily identified in his stomach. In fact, the coroner, Dr. Thompson, said he had never seen a stomach in such a state. It was as a result of these findings that Harriet Tarver was convicted of murder. It would seem, to her surprise, she had apparently fully expected to be acquitted.
She finally confessed to killing Thomas, and the press reported that her motive was that she was in love with another man. She was not given much time to reflect upon her crime, however, for the day after her trial, on the 9th of April, 1836, she became the youngest woman in 19th century Gloucester to be hanged by the neck until she was dead.
The verses published in the broadsheets to celebrate her execution read as follows. Good people, all I pray attend unto these lines that I have penned. A criminal confined I lie, my crime is of the blackest dye. Harriet Tarver is my name. You'll hear from Camden Town in Gloucestershire, I own the dreadful deed I've done, and now my glass is nearly run. A loving husband once I had, which ought have made a wife's heart glad, but Satan he tempted him so, that I resolved the deed to do. To poison him was my intent, and to take his life I was fully bent. White arsenic I did apply, which for the same I'm condemned to die. By him a lovely child I bore, and alas, I ne'er shall see it more. O Lord, thou be a parent kind to my orphan child which I leave behind. God grant it may a warning take of its mother's untimely fate. From the paths of vice and bad company, from all such crimes, pray keep it free. When my trial came on you here, with a heavy heart I did appear. The jury they did guilty cry, and soon I was condemned to die. Back to the death cell I was ta'en, 48 hours to remain, and there my time to spend in prayer, hoping to meet my Saviour there. You married women, where'er you be, I pray take warning now by me. Pray love your husband and children too, and God his blessing will bestow. Hark, now I hear my passing bell, now I must bid this world farewell. And when the fatal bolt shall fall, the Lord have mercy on my soul. We move south now from Chipping Campden to Boughton-on-the-Hill, for it's here that our next tale took place.
The Cotswolds was a perfect area for opportunistic thieves. In a rural region like this, there was a clear line between rich and poor. Robert Jones fell clearly into the latter category. He regarded anyone wealthier than himself as fair game, and his last victim was a man called Stephen Matthews. Stephen was a farmer from Hinchwick, a village not far from Boughton-on-the-Hill, and was known in the local community to be very wealthy. He regularly passed through here on his way to Evesham Market, where he sold his livestock.
One day, on Monday the 21st of May, 1767, having made the then large sum of £200, he got on his horse and started to ride the distance back home, which was about 15 miles. He took roads which can be taken today, what is now the A44 from Evesham to here at Boughton-on-the-Hill, and then over the Boughton Downs, down narrow, winding tracks to his home. His route would be well known to locals, including the criminal Robert Jones. In the 18th century, on horseback and in the dark, this route must have been distinctly scary and atmospheric. Highwaymen were known to frequent these kinds of tracks, but Matthews knew the area well and probably felt safe in such familiar territory. Robert Jones took advantage of this and lay in wait on the route to Hinchwick, hiding in some grass on the roadside, watching for Matthews to pass. It is unclear precisely what happened at this point, but it proceeded in as violent a manner as one might expect. One version of events suggests that as Matthews approached, he stopped to relieve himself on the grass verge, this making Jones's job easier. As Matthews remounted his horse with one foot in the stirrup, Jones rushed him and hit him on the head with a wooden paddle. He continued to hit him as he fell to the ground and then robbed him of 17.5 guineas. Matthew's body was found the following day with many injuries, suggesting gratuitous violence on Jones's part, encouraging the belief that this was a premeditated murder. As in our previous story, rumors spread like wildfire as to the culprit. Robert Jones had not been slightly careful since the event. He had paid off his debts to local innkeepers and boasted about the fact that he didn't need money. This immediately raised suspicions, and just 2 days after the murder, he was apprehended by a Joseph Knight of Stowe and Mr. Wilkes of Chipping Norton. Much of the stolen money was found on his person. He hadn't had much opportunity to spend it. He was committed to Gloucester Castle, where he continued to insist on his innocence. He claimed that a watch they found in his possession was a brand new one he'd purchased from a Broadway jeweller, but there was conclusive evidence that this watch had belonged to Matthews. It had received a new seal 2 days before the incident, and this same seal was found on the stolen watch.
A truly badly behaved prisoner, he was tried on August the 3rd and sentenced to execution. He was hanged on the 5th, and on the following day, his body was brought here to Bourton-on-the-Hill, where it hung bound in chains to act as a warning to other opportunistic thieves and criminals.
We continue south to the town of Stowe-on-the-Wold. Murder and robbery. £200 reward, whereas a barbarous murder was committed on the evening of the 10th of March at Stowe-on-the-Wold on the body of Mr. Francis James Wrens of Stowe aforesaid, and a gold watch taken from his person.
So reads a wanted poster issued after the death of Francis James Wrens in 1834. It goes on to describe the stolen gold watch in some detail and states that a reward will be paid by Mr. John D. Charles of Stowe-on-the-Wold. To who shall give such information as may lead to the conviction of the perpetrator or perpetrators of the said murder? The victim was François Jacques Wrens, a Frenchman who came to live a quiet life in the English countryside. His name, as per the wanted poster, was anglicized by the locals. He'd been a businessman and a merchant working in the Netherlands, but had moved to England after the failure of his business.
After coming to England, he was seen as an upstanding member of the local community. He taught French, and in 1827 he managed to secure a position as the actuary of the Stowe Provident Bank. This is what brought him to Stowe. He stayed at the George Inn in Market Square and would frequently walk around town after his evening meal.
Sadly, his habits made him easy to keep track of and was consequently an easy target for opportunistic thieves. As in our previous story, there was a deep social divide at the time, and there was a general sense of economic misery for many living poorly in the rural communities. His landlord's daughter, Martha Rogers, had seen him leave for his walk at 7:30 p.m. and she knew he'd be back by 8 to drink tea. When he failed to return, she knew something was amiss. He had last been spotted at about 7:45, walking down Black Lane by a local man, Henry Sutton, who assumed him to be on his usual evening walk. Just minutes later, Wrens was dead, hit over the head from behind with an iron bar.
He was found by Samuel Harris, who was out feeding his horses, who raised the alarm at the George Inn. An Inspector Adamson arrived from London to assist the local authorities, and as usual, many witnesses came forward with conflicting statements. It was eventually narrowed down to two main suspects, a Mr. Clifford and a Mr. Cox, but it soon became clear that these men had little motive, as they had their own trades and respectable incomes. The investigations continued for some time, until eventually another possible culprit was found. Edwin Jeffrey, a 21-year-old local labourer who had aroused suspicions by trying to take an expensive watch to a local watchmaker to have it mended. When questioned on how he came to have the watch, he said it had been a gift from his brother. The watchmaker was not convinced and went to the police. Geoffrey was arrested and put on trial. It came to light that he had waited near a local fish pond for wrens, had seen the watch hanging from his pocket and struck him down. Later, he had actually helped the locals take Renz's body back to the George Inn. He hid the watch for a time, but eventually taking it to the watchmaker for repair was to be his undoing.
He was hanged in Gloucester on the 15th of April, 1835, and was seen praying up until the moment he finally dropped.
We journey to the southwest now, following the escarpment down to Winchcombe, one of the Cotswold explorer's favourite spots. There are a couple of dark stories even here.
In 1864, in the heart of this beautiful town of Winchcombe, the 28-year marriage between Sarah Alexander and Richard Smith was in serious trouble. Sarah had thought she'd married well, as she had been an agricultural labourer and her husband was a respected surgeon. His brother William was a wealthy local farmer. All certainly seemed fine on the surface, but the truth was considerably less peaceful. Not long into their married life, Sarah discovered that Richard had a very dark side to his personality. It turned out his family had a history of insanity. They were Winchcombe born and bred, but two of Richard's uncles were generally known to have been mad. And one of his aunts had been sectioned in the 1830s and committed to the Gloucester County Lunatic Asylum. It seemed pretty likely that when they first married, Sarah had no idea of these family secrets.
There were many warning signs in Richard's behaviour. He had threatened to expel one of his brothers from his house for no apparent reason, and he broke all the windows in his sister Anne's house. In 1846, he was said to have caught brain fever and almost died. As their lives went on, Richard's insanity grew worse. When living in Devon for a spell, he became convinced that a signboard opposite his house was actually a camera documenting his daily movements. He would close all the curtains for days at a time to prevent anyone from seeing in. After a while, his family grew concerned, and in 1852, he was assessed by a Dr. Shapter, who concluded that he suffered from chronic insanity. Despite this, he was allowed to continue his normal life. In fact, his family grew as he and Sarah had their last child, Clara, before moving to London and then back to Winchcombe. Their children had grown up, dispersed, and were living normal lives in a number of different trades, but Richard's madness continued to get worse, and eventually his financial situation began to crumble. He rented a house in North Street in Winchcombe, relying on his brother William, who owned a nearby farm, for financial support. On the 27th of December, 1864, their children had spent the afternoon at Richard and Sarah's home. They were still on affectionate terms, despite Richard's mad spells. They all left at different intervals, with the last of their children, James, leaving at 8:30 in the evening. It was half an hour later, at 9 p.m., that their neighbour, Mrs. Greenhalf, heard a gunshot. She did not, at the time, investigate. The next morning, a Mrs. Wharton knocked on Richard's door, as she normally would, for some milk. She asked after Sarah, but received no reply. After she left, Richard walked to his brother William's farm, and William's son James answered the door. Richard asked for his sister, and as she joined them, he told them calmly that their mother had died. William had joined them too, and in a state of shock, they all left for North Street to find out what had happened. Richard, meanwhile, went to Gloucester Street to tell his other children. William found Sarah dead and called a local surgeon. He found that she'd been shot through the neck, close to the base of the skull. They didn't have to look far for the weapon, that had been left still loaded on a nearby table.
On the 28th of December, 1864, Richard was charged with the willful murder of his wife, Sarah. In the prison records, Richard's entry stands out. Of his fellow prisoners, few were able to read and write, whilst this intelligent and well-educated doctor filled in his entries in full with excellent handwriting.
Despite Richard's defense that it could well have been an accident, his state of mind was the overriding factor. He was surprisingly calm and level-headed during the trial and refused to comment on his actions. He was eventually acquitted on the grounds of insanity. He was imprisoned in Gloucester for 1 year and then sent to Broadmoor Lunatic Asylum, where he stayed until he died in 1833. Fortunately, his many children went on to live perfectly healthy lives, and no dark events took place in the family's history again. Winchcombe is also home to another sinister story of a reprieve that came too late.
Born in 1781, William Townley was a local tearaway and petty criminal. The Townleys were an old local family, and his parents were hardworking and law-abiding. But William and his brother John were made of different stuff. William was just 17 when he was first caught red-handed in the act of burgling a local home.
He and his brother were sent to prison for 2 years, but it didn't seem to do William any good. Immediately after his release, he was back to burgling. In 1803, he was charged with a capital offence. At the time, punishment was pretty severe, and theft could easily incur the death penalty. Later, it was common to be deported to Australia. William was sentenced to be deported, but instead of actually being sent away, he was kept for 7 years on a convict ship at Woolwich, the Justicia. This boat had been used as a prison hulk since 1777 and was notorious for its appalling conditions. He survived this ordeal and was discharged on the 26th of July, 1810. At first, he tried to find legal ways of earning an income. He signed up to the Worcestershire Militia, but squandered his initial pay packet of 10 guineas almost immediately. And he soon returned to his old ways of burglary to solve his financial difficulties. And in October 1810, he broke into the home of one George Skinner. He stole several things, including clothing, but he was promptly caught and once more imprisoned, this time in Gloucester. At his trial in March 1811, various witnesses testified against him, and the best he could do in defence was simply to claim they were all lying. Not surprisingly, he was sentenced to death. His execution date was Saturday the 23rd of March, as executions usually took place on the Saturday following the verdict. Unknown to William, events were taking place to give him another chance in life. The judge who had presided over William's trial was travelling to Hereford, and on his way, he was told things that showed William in a much less hopeless light. The judge decided to grant him a reprieve.
From this moment, however, it all started to go wrong. The decision to reprieve William should have been sent to the Under-Sheriff of Gloucestershire, but went instead to Herefordshire. It sat in the Hereford post office until the next day, by which time the fleetest possible horse taken by the messenger to Gloucestershire wasn't fast enough to save the unfortunate youth.
When it finally arrived, William Townley had been hanging from the gallows for 20 minutes. A tragic tale.
Yeah. That was quite disturbing. A special message for Patrick Cornelius Robert III, Thursday. We will be entertained by David Politis. However, this time, it will be David Politis in his own words telling us his personal and most unusual wilderness stories. So that should be as exciting as hauling 40 tons of rock. The cold case of John Doe found murdered near Anchorage in 1989 has been partly solved. Alaska State Police announced on Wednesday that the unknown man, previously known only as Fire Island John Doe, has been identified as Michael Allison Beavers, age 41, of Chugiak. The investigation into the murder of Michael Beavers is ongoing. Here's the case background. On July 24th, 1989, people on the western side of Fire Island, just southwest of Anchorage, Alaska, made a gruesome find while walking on the beach. A partially decomposed human body, still dressed in a green t-shirt. Autopsy determined that the body belonged to a white male, likely 30 to 50 years old, who stood 6'1" and weighed about 180 pounds and had brown or black facial and body hair. You know, that sounds a lot like me, with the exception of the skin tone. He also had an overbite, which I don't have, and a long-heeled broken nose, which I don't have. He had been dead at least a year before being found. Undisclosed evidence on the body showed he had been murdered. The case in Fire Island, John Doe, went cold relatively quickly. For months, he lay in the morgue as investigators tried to piece together his identity. There were no matches in dental or fingerprint records. In tracing the man's only personal effect, a green Designer's Alive t-shirt with a label reading Capistrane Beach, California, ultimately went nowhere. He was finally buried in Anchorage Municipal Cemetery in 2002. His DNA samples were sent to CODIS, but had no matches. In 2021, Alaska Bureau of Investigations partnered with the Texas genomics company Orthrum to identify Fire Island John Doe. After extracting a new, more detailed sample, investigators set about building a family tree with the DNA. They didn't have to work for long. Several people showed up as genetic relatives of John Doe. Subsequent genealogical research revealed they were all related to an Alaska man who disappeared in 1979. For confirmation, Alaska State Police tracked down an unnamed family member of the man's who provided a DNA sample for comparison. Their DNA was a suitable close match to Fire Island John Doe. On Wednesday, December 1st, 2021, Alaska State Troopers announced that Fire Island John Doe was identified as Michael Allison Beavers, 41. He was last seen leaving his home in Chugiak, just 30 miles from Fire Island, in late 1979. He told his wife he's going to drive to Seattle for a business trip. He was a heavy equipment operator who ran his own excavation business. Beavers never made it to Seattle. He was reported missing in January of 1980. The case was closed due to lack of information 2 years later, and Beavers was legally declared dead in 92. Michael Beavers' genealogical identification marks Alaska's second success with the technique in October, investigators announced that they had contracted with genetic genealogy company Farabon Nanolabs and identified Horseshoe Harriet, a woman found in 1984 as Anchorage resident Robin Pelkey. Pelkey was murdered at age 19 by serial killer Robert Hansen. And here are a couple of sources to that story if you wish to read further. Very interesting. The power, see, and today I always jokingly tell people, you know, it's only a crime until you get caught. It would be almost, unless you have the ability to stop time. Well, think about this. I've thought about this in some detail. There was a Twilight Zone episode years ago where a woman was digging in her flower bed, found a necklace. She thought it looked nice, so she was wearing it. Married, I think, had two or three kids. One of those typical family nights where the mother's washing dishes and the kids are screaming at each other and husband's watching some TV show with the volume too loud or whatever it is, and dogs barking or cats meowing or birds are chirping or phones ringing, who knows what. The mother gets frustrated and just says, "Oh, would you all just be quiet?" And then time stops. And then I think she says, "Start talking," or whatever, and people start talking. Which is interesting because it kind of goes through a montage where you see her, you know, cleaning the house at her leisure, you know, doing the dishes at her leisure, laundry at her leisure, then just kind of sitting out in the sun, drinking lemonade. I think this happened to her. I'm making it up. I do remember one specific point where she was grocery shopping at her leisure. And then instead of checking out, she just sort of estimated how much the food cost and then put that amount of money in the cashier's hand and then walked out, which I'm not sure if that would work. So very long story short, it ends and there's impending World War III, and she screams, "Would you all be quiet?" and looks up at the sky and you see, I think, the missiles taking off from the U.S. and missiles coming in. I forget how it goes. Anyway, I forget what that show is called. Anyway, I thought, if I were to commit, in order to commit the perfect crime, you would have to literally be able to stop time. Now hear me out. Go. Commit the crime and then return to the previous spot and make certain the spot you leave, there are people, there are cameras, what have you, right? So that little hiccup might just appear, you know, there's a glitch in the camera or something. Because even if they had footage of you, say, in, you know, say you live in Maine, and apparently there's somebody witnessed you at that time in California, you would say, "Wait a minute. At 12:13 p.m., Jane Swanson is clearly seen on camera walking into the bank, waiting in line after filling out a slip. The timestamp of the deposit indicates this. The teller behind the counter verified that she was there, etc., etc." Yes, blah, blah, criminal tips by Mario. I'm just saying. I mean, if you had the ability to stop time, you would never be late. You'd always have enough sleep. You'd get all your stuff done in time. It's not just criminal acts. I mean, somebody could say something that really, really pissed you off, and you could just say your little phrase, "Oh, just be quiet." And then you could sit and, you know, not get limbic hijacked and just think of a very nice professional, perhaps curt retort. I'm just saying, blah, blah. Not only would it be beneficial for crimes. I mean, think about it. Would you commit crimes if you could stop time? Would you go to various stores, fast food joints, wherever, in tellers that were open, or open up a teller and just, you know, take out $1 or $5. You have to go to quite a few of them to make any real money, but if you do that every day, but why would you even want to do that? You could just go and, you know, just go to the grocery store and just get the bare necessities. Gosh. See, but people would make mistakes. People would go and do big items, right? They would probably still live in their same house or apartment or what have you, and then go to, you know, your favorite electronics store and buy the flashiest TV, right? All the gadgets. Gosh, You wouldn't even need to work. I mean, you'd have to. That's that. See, therein lies the problem. That's how criminals get caught, right? People who, I think I told you the story. My grandparents have a cabin in McGregor, and actually, I'm going to see if I can actually Google this story. The McGregor State Bank. No, it wasn't. It wasn't 1876. It wasn't Jesse James in Northfield. Oh, this had to have been 19. Gosh, what year was this? Had to have been 1980 something. And the reason he ended up getting caught, he was, I think these two bars are still in McGregor, Minnesota. Google it. The Buckhorn Bar and Mark's Bar. He was at either one of those two bars. And he was buying drinks for everybody. And people thought that was awfully suspicious. They ended up getting caught. So if he went to the bar, bought drinks for everybody, blabbed, he would have gotten away with it. See, that's the problem with criminals, is they end up doing stupid things, and that's how they end up getting caught. But again, I mean, I don't, you know, what do I know? I'm just a dude who rambles on about various things, about this, that, and the other. All right, folks, we haven't done this in a while. This week's economics lesson with Thomas Sowell.
One of the sad things is that we talk in this country as if slavery was something unique to the United States or to blacks and whites.
All right, folks, we haven't done this in a while. This week's economics lesson.
1619 is as important as 1776.
Yes. Our decision to buy that first group of 20 to 30 Africans would influence almost everything that would follow after. I think it is foundational. It is as foundational to who we became as a country as our decision in 1776 to break off from the British.
Recently, some school districts have decided that they'll be teaching a unit on early American history based on the New York Times 1619 project, which illustrates how the founding of this country is inextricably tied to the institution of slavery.
One of the sad things is that we talk in this country as if slavery was something unique to the United States or to blacks and whites. And in point of fact, slavery was one of the oldest institutions among human beings. They go back as far as there is recorded history. Archaeological finds suggest that slavery existed before human beings could read and write. So what race, a racial difference between the slaves and the enslavers, that is a relatively new phenomenon. You didn't have in ancient times the ability to go to another continent and move millions of people across, of a different race, across the ocean. So you enslaved the people who were nearby. The Europeans enslaved Slavs for centuries before they brought the first black African to the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, but so you're not suggesting, you do not wish to say anything other than that slavery as practiced in the United States was, it may have been recent, but you'd argue, you'd be willing to grant that it was particularly perverse and destructive because race got mixed into it at that point, right?
Race got mixed into it in the United States more than anywhere else for a very simple reason. The United States was founded, as the Declaration said, of Independence, said all men are created equal.
Right.
If that's true, then the only way you can justify slavery is to say that some men are less than men.
I see. So the racial
But in Brazil, where Brazil imported more slaves than the United States, there was no such ideology. Brazil was not a democratic country. The whole issue never arose.
I see.
One of the most pervasive stereotypes about black Americans is that of the absent black father. Where does this toxic idea about black fathers even come from? Well, one theory takes it back to a 1965 report titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. The report became one of the most contentious political documents in 20th century America. Democrat and Assistant Secretary of Labor Daniel Patrick Moynihan put the report together to make the argument for how the Lyndon B. Johnson administration had to do more for racial equality than simply pass the Voting Rights Act. Moynihan argued that to really fight racial inequality, the government had to understand the state of black communities and why they were the way they were. But Moynihan ended up focusing on one thing, the Black family. According to him, the fundamental reason for growing economic inequality between white and Black Americans was a crumbling family structure in Black communities. And at the foundation of the so-called crumbling Black family structure was the absent Black father. Moynihan looked at non-marital birth rates and rates of fathers living separately from their children and made a whole bunch of assumptions about parents' relationship statuses and parental involvement. The report didn't take into account factors like the legacy of slavery, generational wealth, or even economic migration in which men left their homes so that they could provide for their families.
A fallacy is that the current fatherless families so prevalent among contemporary Blacks are a legacy of slavery, where families were not recognized under slavery. This ignores the fact that the problem has become much worse among generations of Blacks far removed from slavery than among generations closer to the era of slavery, yes. Close quote. Explain that.
You mean explain why it is so? Or
yeah, see, why is that? Why? What on earth is going on there? That is so counter to what we assume.
Well, first of all, most people have not recognized the fact that if you go back into the 20s, you find that married couple families were much more prevalent among Blacks then than today. Most Black kids grew up in homes with two parents under slavery itself and for generations thereafter. And as late as the 1960s, most Black children grew up in two-parent homes. When you think about it, I mean, centuries of slavery, generations of Jim Crow did not destroy the Black family, but one generation of the welfare state did. Moynihan was excoriated for pointing this out.
1965, the Moynihan report. That's right,
yes.
The Moynihan report.
People took this as a way of putting down Blacks. What they don't understand was that, one, Moynihan was a scholar who knew that his own group, the Irish Americans, had that very same problem at the beginning of the 20th century. And more importantly, Moynihan's own father deserted the family when he was 10 years old.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He and his brother were out shining shoes in Times Square and Central Park to try to bring in a few pennies to help to keep the house going. And so where they'd been living in this wonderful suburban area, suddenly they were in a very rough neighborhood and they were shining shoes in Times Square to try to make ends meet. And so he understood that this was one heck of a problem that people should be warned about. And he was simply excoriated.
Black Americans, a group often identified as beneficiaries of the welfare state in America, made considerable economic progress in the 20th century. Fine, of course, but much, if not most. This is the thing with you. The dependent clause is where the sting is. But much, if not most, of this progress was prior to the massive expansion of the American welfare state. Close quote. That is so counterintuitive, because we hear so much about African-American progress since civil rights and the establishment of the welfare state that it really has become a kind of American intuition. Explain yourself, Dr. Sowell.
Well, as of 1940, 87% of Black households were in poverty. Over the next 20 years, that declined to 47%. This is all prior to the civil rights laws, prior to the social welfare policies of the Johnson administration. Over the next 20 years, it fell an additional 18 points. But that was just the same trend continuing at a reduced rate. Affirmative action is even worse. Poverty rate was something like 30% among Black households before affirmative action. And a decade after affirmative action, it was 29%. This is not the same as the 40% decline that occurred before there were any civil rights laws and before there was any social welfare state.
Race and discrimination, you suggest, are not so closely linked that they move up and down together. First of all, distinguish the two, race and discrimination.
Racism is an attitude inside people's heads.
Right.
Discrimination is an overt act taking place outside in the real world.
Okay.
So not only with Blacks, but you find the same thing with Jews in previous centuries, that part of the United States where there was the most racism against Blacks, namely the South,
right,
is where Black construction workers were much more common than they were in the North, right on into the 20th century. Most people are unaware that in the South, blacks were the construction workers. I remember a professor at Howard University saying that when he was a boy in the South, his father pointed to some man on the street and said, he was the first black construction, first white construction worker in this town.
And so what was going on there? The racism did not, so whites could think of blacks as somehow or other separate, but they'd still employ them. Because the market made it profitable to do so.
Yeah, in fact, a law had to be passed to stop this because in the 20s, and particularly as the Depression got underway, black construction companies in the South using black non-union labor would come up to the North and underbid on government contracts, taking them away. So this was very common to the point where they passed the Davis-Bacon Act, which said that on government contracts, you must pay the prevailing wage, which was translated almost invariably into the union wage.
Right. So your point on the distinction between racism and discrimination is, don't worry about racism. It's inside people's heads. You can't measure it. There's a strongly subjective, just forget about it. Concentrate only on discrimination. And the best answer to discrimination is to let markets operate, because then people will discover, it will tend to militate against discrimination.
Oh, yes,
when people have skills to offer, they'll be employed. Whatever this notion of racism in people's heads is, don't worry about that. Is that right?
Yeah, what I'm saying essentially is that racists may prefer one race to another, but they prefer themselves to everybody else.
So they'll do what's profitable.
That's right.
It would be very hard, for example, for a basketball owner, no matter how racist he was, to try to operate without blacks. Mm-hmm.
As you showed in the case of the Washington Redskins.
Yes, because there they had a policy of trying to keep blacks off the team for a long time. And it so happened that almost all the leading running backs of that era were black. And, of course, as the Washington Redskins began to lose more and more games, it wasn't very long before they decided they had better get Bobby Mitchell from Cleveland and put him in the lineup, as they did.
We are almost done, kiddies. Yes, blah, blah. All those white guys on the basketball team are wondering about equality. Yes, they are. Nobody cares about sweatshops in Nike-made shoes until it serves their political need, like I keep telling people. What did we learn this evening? Well, we learned once again that perhaps Hollywood actors are acting. We had some murder, mayhem, and mystery from across the ocean. DNA, once again, solves not one, not two, but three recent cases. We may have a connection to the I-70 serial killer. And Thursday, we will hear from the words. We will hear the words from Politis regarding his most mysterious and unusual cases, which I am of the opinion at this point may be slightly fabricated. Trust me, there will be most likely numerous pauses during the program to make what some may refer to as snide comments. We'll talk about that on Thursday. In the meantime, head on over to revolution.radio, common spelling in your favorite internet browser at the website, top of the page, nav bar. You'll see two important buttons, store donations. Click on both of those, purchase some items. They go to support this internet workhorse. Donations do that as well. Every donation, every Lincoln penny to Benjamin Franklin paper bill, go to support what we do here. Thank you, Pac. Yes, Pagan, I will again be interrupting because sometimes I just can't keep my mouth shut. Otherwise, that's it. Enjoy the rest of your evening. We will talk with you on Thursday at 5:03 p.m. Central Time, 6:03 p.m. Eastern Times. And in the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
you for listening to Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.